Good morning. This is the BBC World News for the 18th of February, 2026, read by Steve Hoff. As usual, we start today with the U.S. and Canada. Top headline today, no DNA match on gloves found in Nancy Guthrie case, police say. A glove discovered as part of the investigation into Nancy Guthrie's kidnapping has produced no DNA matches, says authorities in Pima County, Arizona. Found about 2 miles from the Guthrie home, the glove appeared to match one worn by the suspect in the doorbell camera footage taken the night she disappeared. The DNA from the glove was sent for testing on last Thursday, but produced no matches in CODIS, the FBI's database of DNA from offenders. However, the local sheriff told the BBC that said DNA may still play a role in finding Guthrie. Nancy Guthrie, mother of NBC television anchor Savannah Guthrie, has been missing since the 1st of February, when officials say she was taken from her home against her will. The family have made repeated pleas for the return of the 84-year-old. In his comments to the BBC, Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos said he believed Guthrie was the victim of a targeted kidnapping and that she was being held somewhere close to her home in Tucson. Nanos, who is leading the hunt, said he was confident they would find her, whether it took 10 days, 10 months, or worse. End quote. Detectives have received close to 40,000 tips from the public, he added. Nanos said he did not see the lack of DNA matches as a setback and added that DNA could still play a crucial part in solving the case. The glove was just one of several that were collected from various locations near Guthrie's residence, though most turned out to have been discarded by people searching for the missing woman. Last week, investigators released video footage taken from a doorbell camera at Guthrie's front door that showed a masked man wearing gloves and a backpack. In the video, the suspect walks towards the camera and tries to cover it with his gloved hand before grabbing some brush from the front yard to block the camera's view. After conducting a forensic analysis of the video, the FBI said it believed the man was between 5'9" and 5'10", tall, and of average build. The sheriff's department said it was working with Walmart to determine who purchased a backpack worn by the suspect in the video, which is exclusively sold by Walmart. More than 2 weeks since Guthrie, 84, was reported missing, no arrests have been made, the sheriff's department confirmed on Tuesday. However, authorities noted that more DNA found at her home was being analyzed and that they are exploring other investigative genetic genealogy databases for DNA matches. Police said over the weekend that the Guthrie family, including Nancy Guthrie's children and their spouses, were not suspects in her abduction. Nanos described Guthrie's children and the rest of her family instead as victims in the disappearance. Guthrie's three children have posted multiple videos online pleading for their mother's safe return in the 2 weeks since her disappearance, saying they were willing to pay her abductors. Over the weekend, Savannah Guthrie posted another such video that addressed a potential kidnapper directly. Quote, "It's never too late to do the right thing," she said. "We are here and we believe in the essential goodness of every human being." Guthrie was last seen on the evening of the 31st of January when a family member dropped her off at her home following a get-together at her daughter's, Annie Guthrie's, house. Members of her church noticed her absence the following day and notified her family. A massive search team mounted by both local police and the FBI have since been combing through Guthrie's house and the surrounding area. Officials have warned that Guthrie needs regular medication and is not in good physical health. They have said she has no reported cognitive issues. Police have also found blood on the floor of Guthrie's porch, front porch that is, that was confirmed to be hers. The FBI has increased the reward for information about her disappearance from $50,000 to $100,000. And this headline from California. Rescuers search for nine missing skiers after California avalanche. Nine backcountry skiers are missing following an avalanche in California's Lake Tahoe region on Tuesday, authorities said. Six others have been rescued after they became stranded, the Nevada County Sheriff's Office said. The avalanche was reported about 11:30 Pacific Standard Time in the morning in the Castle Peak area near the town of Truckee, according to officials. Weather conditions remain dangerous with a high chance of further avalanches. Highly skilled rescue ski teams have deployed from two nearby ski resorts, the sheriff said. The six known survivors have been, quote, directed to shelter in place as best as they can in the conditions. Officials initially reported that a group of 16 people in total, four guides and 12 clients, were involved, though that number was later lowered to 15. The six initially reported skiers who survived the avalanche have been successfully rescued this evening. The sheriff's office wrote on Facebook late on Tuesday night. Two of the six rescued skiers were taken to hospital. Experts from the nearby Burial Mountain Ski Resort and the Adder Creek Adventure Center are also attempting to reach the site. An earlier statement posted by the sheriff's office said that 46 emergency responders had joined the rescue efforts. The Sierra Avalanche Center wrote in a forecast, quote, "Large avalanches are expected to occur on Tuesday, Tuesday night, and into at least early Wednesday morning across backcountry terrain." The Avalanche Center listed the danger area as, quote, "high," a 4 out of 5 on a rating scale. Travel in, near, or below avalanche terrain is not recommended today. A widespread natural avalanche cycle is expected over the next 24 hours, the center said. Large avalanches may run through treed areas. The avalanche that trapped the skiers was rated as a D2.5 on a scale of D1 to D5. The Sierra Avalanche Center forecaster, Steve Renault, told local outlet ABC News 10. D2 avalanches can injure, bury, or kill people, according to the avalanche.org. So this one was a 2.5. Renault told ABC that the skiers were on the last day of a 3-day backpack skiing trip. He said the skiers spent 2 nights in huts on the trip that involved navigating rugged mountainous terrain for 4 miles while carrying food and supplies. A spokesperson for the sheriff's office told local news, told a local news station that it would be a slow, tedious process to find the missing skiers because of the high avalanche risk posed to the rescuers. As of around 5:15 local time, he said first responders, including some on skis, were still trying to reach the avalanche zone and that those alive were sheltering under tarpaulin sheets, doing the best they can to survive. He said it is not uncommon for ski tour companies to take paying customers out into such conditions, adding, "I don't think it was a wise choice, but we don't know all the details yet." California Governor Gavin Newsom's office said in a post on X that state authorities were coordinating an all-hands search and rescue effort with local emergency teams. The Boer El Mountain Ski Resort, which is near where the accident occurred, has reported 30 inches of snowfall in the past 24 hours. The resort decided to close on Tuesday because of high winds and low visibility. The storm has also closed several highways, including Interstate 80 and Highway 50. Next, U.S. civil rights leader Jesse Jackson dies at 84. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson died at age 84 on Tuesday morning, surrounded by relatives, according to a statement released by his family. Quote, "It is with profound sadness that we announce the passing of civil rights leader and founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition, the Honorable Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson Sr.," the family said, adding that he had died peacefully. The cause of death has not yet been released, but Jackson had been diagnosed with progressive supranuclear palsy, PSP, and was in hospital late last year. Tributes poured in for the prominent activist who twice ran for the Democratic presidential nominee for president, including from the first black U.S. president, Barack Obama. Jackson is survived by his wife, Jacqueline, and their children, Santinita, Jesse Jr., Jonathan, Yusef, Jacqueline, and Ashley. Jackson's family said in their statement that his unwavering commitment to justice, equality, and human rights helped shape a global movement for freedom and dignity, end quote. A tireless change agent, he elevated the voices of the voiceless from his presidential campaigns in the 80s to mobilizing millions to register to vote, leaving an indelible mark on history. Alongside working with Martin Luther King Jr. and running for president in 1984 and 1988, Jackson is remembered as the founder of a nonprofit organization focused on social justice and civil rights, the Rainbow Push Coalition. Calling Jackson a true giant, Obama said in a statement that Jackson's two historic runs for president had laid the foundation for my own campaign to the highest office of the land. Obama added that his wife, Michelle, got her first glimpse of political organizing at the Jackson kitchen table when she was a teenager. For more than 60 years, Reverend Jackson helped lead some of the most significant movements for change in human history. From organizing boycotts and sit-ins to registering millions of voters to advocating for freedom and democracy around the world, he was relentless in his belief that we are all children of God, deserving of dignity and respect. U.S. President Donald Trump said he knew Jackson, quote, long before becoming president. He was a good man with lots of personality, grit, and street smarts. He was gregarious, someone who truly loved people, end quote. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton and his wife, Hillary, a former Secretary of State, also shared tributes saying they were friends with Jackson for almost 50 years. And then there's this headline, a little closer to home. Suspect in Rhode Island ice hockey shooting killed his ex-wife and son. Two victims shot dead at a high school ice hockey game in Rhode Island have been identified as the suspect's ex-wife and son. Robert Dorgan, who police said also went by the names of Roberta Espinito and Roberta Dorgan, was found dead inside the Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket on Monday, apparently from a self-inflicted gunshot wound after what authorities said was a targeted attack. Dorgan's ex-wife, Rhonda Dorgan, and adult son, Aiden Dorgan, died. Rhonda's mother and father, along with family friend, were injured. All three were in critical condition at the hospital. Police have not given a motive, but said it appeared to be a family dispute. Video of the incident showed shots fired while players were on the rink, sparking panic as the teams scrambled to leave the arena, which is located a few miles from the state capital of Providence. Asked at a news conference on Tuesday if the shooting followed a confrontation, Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Gonzalez said no. She said two guns were recovered from the scene, a Glock 10mm pistol and a Sig Sauer P226 were legally owned. Gonzalez told reporters a bystander stepped in and interjected, and that probably is what led to a swift end to this tragic event. Court documents show that Rhonda Dorgan filed for divorce from Robert Dorgan, 56 years old, in February of 2020. In a petition she wrote, quote, gender reassignment surgery, narcissistic plus personality disorder traits as grounds for their divorce. Those words appear to have been crossed out and replaced with irreconcilable differences. That same month, the shooter filed a police report asking authorities to file charges against the father-in-law, alleging he had threatened to have Dorgan killed. Dorgan's father-in-law was alleged to have used a derogatory term for transgender people, and police filed a criminal charge against him, which was later dismissed. The police chief said officers were combing through thousands of the suspect's social media posts, but added that Dorgan's gender identity was, quote, irrelevant to the investigation at this point, end quote. What I can tell you is the identification was in the name of Robert, and then we also know that the suspect went by the name Roberta. It appears that the suspect was in female clothes yesterday, but again, that's nothing that had swayed the investigation one way or the other. A family statement posted for the online fundraiser said, quote, "Our family has been forever changed by these tragic events at Lynch Arena. In addition to this unimaginable loss, their grandparents are currently in critical condition, fighting for their lives. General Dynamics Bath Ironworks, a Navy contractor based in Bath, Maine, confirmed that Dorgan was one of its employees. The company said in a statement, "We extend our deepest sympathies to the victims, their families, and all those affected by this tragedy." Authorities have spoken to dozens of witnesses to the attack. Many families were watching the game and ran in fear as gunfire broke out. Melissa Dunn, whose son plays for one of the hockey teams, said she saw paramedics performing CPR in the stands of the arena after she ran back inside to find her son. "You don't know what's going on at first," Dunn said. "You just hear the loud noises, and we're used to the kids banging on the boards with their skates. So we thought it was that at first." She said she screamed for her son to duck and avoid gunfire. "We ran out of the rink. Your first thought is, where's my kid?" I tried to get back into the ring, and I actually got in there to find out where he was. And I saw them doing CPR in the stands, and it was just really disturbing. Moving on to the United Kingdom. UK inflation rate falls to 3%, helped by the cost of petrol and bread. Here's the summary. The UK inflation rate fell to 3% in the year to January, the Office of National Security says. The drop had been forecast by economists, and it was the Office of National Statistics say it was driven in part by the cost of bread, cereal, and petrol. It's a fall from December's 3.4 rate, but inflation remains above the Bank of England's 2% target. Business owners tell the BBC they are still struggling with price rises. The head of the a tea brand blames transport costs, while a bakery owner says, for her, it's the price of ingredients. Chancellor Rachel Reeves says decisions made in the November budget are bringing down inflation. But Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride says, quote, families are still feeling the pinch because of labor's economic mismanagement, end quote. Inflation measures the rate of price rises over time and is calculated by looking at a common purchases. The next headline, plan to increase youth minimum wage could be delayed. Ministers are considering slowing down plans to pay adults of all ages the same minimum wage. Labor committed in their election manifesto to remove, quote, discretionary age bands and increase the wages of 18 to 20-year-olds so they are paid the same as those over 21. But government sources have confirmed ministers are interested in delaying that raise, though it is unlikely to reverse the commitment entirely. Some business leaders say minimum wage increases are making it too expensive for them to hire young people. But unions say it is unfair that the young can be paid less for doing the same job as older people. The government has already made a start on ending the gap between minimum pay for younger and older workers. The hourly rate for 18 to 20-year-olds will rise by 85 pence to £10.85 in April, with under 18s and apprentices getting 45 pence more to £8 per hour. That comes on top of a 16.3% rise for 18 to 20-year-olds in 2024. The minimum wage for those aged 21 and older has been raising at a similar rate and is due to go up by 50 pence to £12.71 per hour in April. That leaves a gap of £1.86 an hour between younger and older workers, which the government has committed to closing before the next election in 2029. I've been dying to say this. This headline just in. Children injured by NHS can claim damages for lifetime loss of earnings, court rules. The Supreme Court ruling is likely to lead to significantly higher damages being awarded to children injured by medical negligence. Until now, children have only been entitled to compensation for lost earnings, pay missed out on by not being able to work for years they were expected to live. But the court ruling on a case of a child who sustained a brain injury at birth in 2015 found that compensation should take into account the full working life she would have had if she had not been harmed at birth. The decision could have significant cost implications for the NHS. The child at the center of this case, born in 2015 at Sheffield Teaching Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, is not being named. During labor, monitoring indicated that her heartbeat was abnormal, but this was not acted on. She was born with signs of oxygen deprivation, requiring resuscitation, and later scans confirmed a severe hypoxic brain injury. The trust admitted failures in her care. The girl has severe cerebral palsy, is unable to walk or talk, and has severe visual impairment and epilepsy, and requires continuous 24-hour care. In 2023, the High Court awarded a lump sum of £6,866,615, an additional payment of £394,940 per year linked to inflation. This was to cover the cost of her care needs and for loss of earnings up to the age of 29, her life expectancy. Wednesday's Supreme Court verdict, by a majority, has ruled that the compensation should take into account her entire loss of earnings and pension for a full working life. It said that the trust and the family's lawyers were agreed that had the girl not been injured, she would have enjoyed a normal life expectancy, obtained a GCSEs, worked until age 68, and received a pension. The additional damages will now be decided on a later date. Lawyers for the family claim it amounts to more than £800,000. The girl's mother said in a statement that she felt elated that my girl's little girl has changed the law and that this will help lots of other children who have been injured through no fault of their own. The ruling brings the law in cases involving children into line with adolescents and adults who have suffered life-shortening injuries who were already able to claim for lost years. The court found there was no basis in law for injured children to have their claims treated differently. Moving on to Africa. Turkey's president rejects Israel's recognition of Somaliland. Turkey's president, Erdogan, has rejected Israel's recognition of the breakaway region of Somaliland as an independent nation. During a visit to Ethiopia, Erdogan said it could prove dangerous for a volatile region. In December, Israel became the first country to recognize Somaliland, which declared independence from Somalia more than 30 years ago. The move upset Mogadishu, which still considers Somaliland as part of its territory. Landlocked Ethiopia has yet to comment, but its plans 2 years ago to lease a piece of Somaliland's coastline to build a port angered Somalia at the time, and it was Erdogan who mediated an end to the dispute that had prompted fears of a wider conflict. In reaction to Erdogan's comments, Somaliland's foreign ministry said that Turkey, which has in recent years become an important geopolitical player in the Horn of Africa, should refrain from inflaming regional tensions. At a joint press conference with Ethiopian Prime Minister, Erdogan said, quote, "The Horn of Africa should not be a battlefield for foreign forces. We believe that countries of the region should address their problems by themselves," end quote. Meanwhile, The prime minister urged Turkey to support Ethiopia's quest for sea access, arguing that it was unjust for a country to remain landlocked. Eritrea officially ceded from Ethiopia in 1993, leaving the country without access to the Red Sea coastline. It is not right for a country with the population of over 130 million to be denied sea access and remain a geographical prisoner for a long time due to the conspiracy of our enemies. Since the Somaliland deal fell through in 2024, the prime minister has been pushing for ownership of Eritrea's southern port of Assab, about 60 miles from its border, and hinted at a desire to take it by force. The prime minister said he had asked Turkey to exert diplomatic pressure and assist peacefully in securing access to the sea. This all comes against the backdrop of fears of a return to conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, which borders Eritrea. During the first Tigray War, which raged between 2020 and 2022, Eritrean forces fought alongside the Ethiopian army against local Tigrayan fighters. But alliances have changed, and any renewed conflict in Tigray is likely to inflame tensions between the neighbors, who fought a devastating border war between 1998 and 2000 that claimed more than 100,000 lives. Next, gold fever hits South Africa after lucky find in a cattle pen. A gold rush has gripped an informal settlement east of the South African city of Johannesburg after reports spread a few days ago about the discovery of some gold particles. A resident in a poor neighborhood of the former mining town of Springs claimed to have found several nuggets while digging at an outdoor enclosure used for cattle. Dozens of people have now descended on the area and have been digging up the fenced area where cows were once penned in, hoping to strike it rich. Armed with pickaxes and shovels, they have been sifting through the soil in scenes reminiscent to the gold rush that helped build South Africa's financial capital more than a century ago. Springs was once a booming gold town, but its mines were closed several years ago because of the extreme depth of the shafts made operations uneconomical. The town is now surrounded by informal settlements. Many of those residents are migrants from neighboring countries. South Africa's Department of Mineral Resources has condemned this week's mining activities in Springs informal settlement, calling it illegal and warning that it was damaging the environment. Some of those digging at the site have told the BBC that they have been able to find gold and have sold it on the black market. Dangerous chemicals like mercury and sodium cyanide are used to separate the gold from the ore. We know this is illegal. We want the government to give us mining permits so we can work and pay taxes, one man who did not want to be named told the BBC. He explained that as a father of two children, he needed to earn money to put them through school and put food on the table. Another man told the BBC, the only hustle we know. It has saved many of us from being arrested for committing serious and violent crimes. A gram of gold is worth about $100. By contrast, the monthly wage in South Africa is $368. Many of those busy digging during the BBC's visit said they originally hailed from the neighboring Lesotho. At around 2 o'clock local time, after the end of the school day, children started arriving at the site. They had gone home first to change out of their uniforms and then rushed to the cattle enclosure to help their parents dig for gold. And on to Asia. Philippine Vice President Sara Duterte to run for president in 2028. Philippine Vice President Sara Duterte has declared her candidacy for president in the 2028 election. The 47-year-old's announcement comes as she is embroiled in a bitter power struggle with current President Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. While the presidential vote is 2 years away, contenders in the Philippines' largely personality-based elections are known to prepare for years in advance. Marcos is ineligible to run for re-election, and his allies have yet to field a challenge to Duterte, who is also the daughter of his predecessor, former President Rodrigo Duterte. I offer my life, my strength, and my future in the service of our nation, the vice president said. I am Sara Duterte, and I will run for the president of the Philippines. Marcos and Duterte ran under the same ticket in the 2022 election, which they won by a landslide. But the alliance soon unraveled as they pursued separate political interests. The feud blew up spectacularly in March of 2025, when Marcos allowed the International Criminal Court to arrest Sara's father. The elder Duterte is now detained at The Hague, awaiting trial for crimes against humanity over his violent war on drugs. 2 months later, a midterm legislative vote, seen as a barometer of support for the incumbent government, delivered a victory for candidates endorsed by the Duterte family against those handpicked by Marcos. Just over a week ago, members of the Catholic clergy filed an impeachment complaint against the vice president over alleged corruption, which she denies. Sara is Rodrigo Duterte's eldest daughter and is widely considered his political heir. The elder Duterte once described his daughter as the alpha in their family, the one whom everyone follows. She served as vice mayor to her father when he led Davao City in the 2010s. It was in that southern metropolis that Duterte's built their reputation for being tough on crime, which they have described as necessary to keep people safe and encourage businesses to grow. Sara was thrust into the national spotlight when, in defense of a shantytown dwellers, she punched the Davao sheriff in full view of TV news cameras. She was Davao mayor when her father was president from 2016 and 2022, and her alliance with Marcos in the 2022 election was pivotal for both their election victories. The vice president, like her father, projects a tough image. She rides a large motorcycle and has given her children nicknames like Sharky, Stonefish, and Stingray. She also shares matching tattoos with her two brothers. Australia bans citizen trying to return from ISIS camp in Syria. Australia has barred a citizen linked to the Islamic State, the IS group, from the country for up to 2 years. The person is among a group of 34 Australian women and children who tried to head home after being released from a Syrian camp earlier this week, only to be turned back by Syrian authorities for, quote, technical reasons. The ban was issued on advice from security agencies, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke said on Wednesday, adding that the other 33 people do not meet required legal thresholds to be banned. Canterbury has refused to repatriate the group, believed to be made up of wives, widows, and children of IS fighters. There are 33 children among them. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese stressed that these families will not receive government support to come back to the country. You made your bed, you lie in it, he told a press conference on Wednesday. These are people who chose to go overseas to align themselves with a brutal, reactionary ideology that seeks to undermine and destroy our way of life, end quote. However, legal experts have warned the government has an obligation to allow citizens to the right of return. And responding to reports, the group has valid Australian passports, Albanese said his government would not breach Australian law. This group in the Al-Rij camp in northern Syria is among dozens of Australians who have been held in camps and prisons across the country since 2019, when IS was driven from its final foothold in Syria. The Al-Rij camp is home to more than 2,000 others from 40 different nationalities, mainly women and children. Among them is thought to be Shamini Begum, who was stripped of her British citizenship in 2019 on national security grounds. Speaking to ABC, the camp's director made an appeal to all countries to have citizens held in limbo there. Take your citizens. Take these children and women. The children are especially growing up surrounded by dangerous ideas and ideologies in the camp, she said. The more time passes, the more complicated the situation becomes. Several of these camps have made headlines as the women and children living in them are severely malnourished and lack access to basic resources. Several other foreign governments, including France, the Netherlands, and the UK, have also refused to repatriate most of their citizens still held in Syria. On to Europe. Difficult Russia-Ukraine peace talks end without a breakthrough. Talks between Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. aimed at ending Moscow's war in Ukraine have concluded without a breakthrough. The trilateral meetings held in Geneva went on late on Tuesday, but only lasted 2 hours on Wednesday. Although U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff had expressed optimism over the talks, both the chief Russian negotiator and Ukraine's President Zelensky indicated they had been, quote, difficult. After the main talks concluded, Kremlin negotiator returned to the venue and held a closed-door meeting with the Ukrainian side for about an hour and a half. No details from that meeting have yet emerged. Some progress was made on military issues, including the location of the front line and ceasefire monitoring, according to a Ukrainian diplomat source. But an agreement on the issue of territory, without which no ceasefire can be envisioned, remained elusive, with Moscow and Kyiv positions still far apart. Russia has not budged on its demand for full control of the eastern Donbas region, while conceding talks were challenging. Kremlin negotiator added that they had been, quote, businesslike, and said other meetings would take place soon. Zelensky also described the negotiations as not easy due to the difference in the two sides' position. Shortly before the end of the talks was announced, Zelensky accused Russia of, quote, trying to drag out negotiations that could already have reached the final stage. Next, food prices are surging in Russia. Is the war hitting Russians in the pocket? Life is becoming more expensive, complains Alexander, a Moscow-based advertising specialist who works for a big corporation. In the course of 1 month, his monthly food budget soared by more than 22%, from $450 to $555. With Russia's economy hanging somewhere between stagnation and decline, ordinary Russians have begun to feel the pinch from the Kremlin's war on Ukraine as it approaches its fourth anniversary. The cost of almost all essentials has gone up in local supermarkets, from eggs and chicken fillets to seasonal vegetables, Alexander has noticed. We have changed the names of everyone we have spoken to for this piece. Even his daily treat on the way to work, an Americano from a local cafe, has surged 26% from 230 rubles to 290 rubles. Prices have risen steadily in Russia since the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, driven by a federal budget dominated by the war effort and defense industry. This, in turn, has led to rapid economic growth and rises in living standards across the country. That rapid economic growth slowed sharply in 2025, and as salaries could no longer keep pace with inflation, rising prices started to hit people's pockets. At the start of 2026, supermarket prices jumped by a sharp 2.3% in less than a month, according to data from the Russia Statistics Service, Rosstat. Everything became more expensive at the start of the year. Meat, milk, salt, flour, potatoes, pasta, bananas, soap, toothpaste, socks, laundry detergent, and many medicines, too. Moving on to Latin America. Peru's Congress ousts president after 4 months in office. Peru's Congress has ousted interim president Jose Jerry just 4 months after he took office for failing to disclose meetings with Chinese businessmen. The scandal unfolded last month after videos emerged of Jerry meeting several times outside of his official schedule with businessman Zhu Yang, who is under government scrutiny. Jerry had previously apologized for the meetings, but denied any wrongdoing and accused his rivals of a political smear campaign. His removal from office makes him the third consecutive president to be ousted after he replaced former leader Dina Bolaro, who was impeached in October of last year. Jerry was Peru's seventh president since 2016 amid a tumultuous political landscape that has seen a succession of leaders leave the post under contentious circumstances. He was not elected by the Peruvian people, but as head of the Congress was sworn in as president after his predecessor, Dina Bolaro, was impeached in October of 2025. While lawmakers had set a date to discuss impeaching Jerry, in the end they opted for a different parliamentary procedure called censure, which only required a simple majority to pass rather than a supermajority needed for impeachment. Later on Wednesday, Congress will name a new interim president who will only serve for a few months until a new president is chosen by the people in a general election this April. And finally, from the Middle East, Iran says, quote, guiding principles agreed to with the U.S. and nuclear talks. Iran has said that it has reached an understanding with the U.S. on the main guiding principles to resolve their dispute over Tehran's nuclear program. Iranian Foreign Minister added that work still needed to be done, and the U.S. said progress was made. The U.S. and its European allies suspect that Iran is moving towards the development of a nuclear weapon, something that Tehran has always denied. Well, that's all we have time for today. I'll pin that one and I'll return to it if there's any updates on Friday.